Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, we're looking at a video from J. Warner Wallace's son, Jimmy Wallace. Jimmy is an apologist of the sit-in-a-parked-car variety, which is slightly better than the film-while-driving variety, but not quite as good as the I-have-a-blog variety. And actually, I don't know if Jimmy Wallace has a blog, to be honest. If he does, I couldn't find it because when you search for Jimmy Wallace, the results are clogged with Jimmy Wallace the guitar maker and retailer. So, an actually potentially useful product, then. I tried to get mad at not being able to find an apologetic site, but then I saw this picture of Jimmy hugging what appears to be a PRS Custom 22, and all my anger just melted away. I can't be mad at a guy who likes PRS guitars, even if they do make it hard for me to find a bad apologetics website that, to this moment, I'm not even sure exists. I'll just have to have faith that it exists, I guess. Let's go!
One of the things I find really interesting about the Bible is the fact that there's four gospel accounts, four stories of the life of Jesus.
Excuse me for a moment while I just get lost in those eyes, which are the perfect shade of a thunderstorm at twilight. I'm not gay, but call me. We'll see where it goes. I'm convinced that if Jimmy here used one of those turn-your-face-into-a-cartoon services, it would just spit out an image of Prince Charming from Shrek.
One of the things I find really interesting about the Bible is the fact that there's four gospel accounts, four stories of the life of Jesus, instead of just one.
Are there four? Depending on how we're counting, there could be many more than four if we're looking to the apocryphal gospels, but if we're just looking at the Bible, then there's basically two, the Synoptics and John. Matthew and Luke both copied directly off of Mark in order to write their accounts, with each making changes to tailor the story for their particular target audience. This would be like looking at a book, looking at the movie and TV show that are based on the book, and then declaring that these three creations make up three independent accounts of the events described in the book. Certainly there will be variations and changes made, with some movies or TV shows being more faithful to the source material than others, but ultimately they are all telling the same story and share an origin. I wouldn't consider the Lord of the Rings movies to be a separate account for the life of Frodo Baggins from the book. Different, sure, but not independent, unique, and separate, and ultimately sharing a source, that is J.R.R. Tolkien.
Three of these come from people who say that they knew Jesus personally.
Wow, really? Three of them? Well, obviously the one that you are not claiming to be authored by a personal acquaintance of Jesus is Luke, since that one opens with the author talking about how he is compiling a story based on other stories that he's heard, which actually would explain pretty well why he was copying from Mark. But if you want to claim that both Matthew and Mark were eyewitnesses, something that neither book actually claims of their authors, and also keeping in mind that they almost certainly were not written by the names that have been traditionally given to them, then why did Matthew copy approximately 90% of Mark verbatim? If he were there, why would he need to plagiarize the work of someone else who was there too instead of writing his own account? If I were to watch a magic show with my family and we all decided to write down what we thought we saw at the show, even if we all describe the events in a perfectly concordant way, there is no chance that any of our essays would include 90% of one of the other essays completely verbatim.
They were eyewitnesses of many of the events that they talk about.
No, absolutely not. None of the gospel authors were eyewitnesses. None of them even claimed to be eyewitnesses. And as mentioned earlier, three out of four of them are mostly identical in content. And not identical in that their stories match up, identical in that they are word-for-word copies of each other. That is not the hallmark of distinct eyewitness accounts.
And the fourth one comes from someone who says he met with the eyewitnesses and then compiled their stories into his gospel.
Yeah, that's Luke. Luke is the one that has the best excuse for being a copy of Mark, and he only copied about 50% of Mark, so it is the one that, were it not for its opening remarks about it being an account compiled from other accounts, would actually be the easiest to claim as a separate eyewitness account from Mark. So, rotten luck there, I guess.
You know, as a Christian, it always gave me great confidence to think that the information I knew about Jesus came from a reliable source, people who really knew what they were talking about.
And how have you determined that these people really knew what they were talking about? Is there any event in the Gospels that is important to the life and ministry of Jesus that has external attestation? I can't think of a single one.
But when I talk to many non-believers, they'll tell me I shouldn't trust the Gospels, that they're not real eyewitness accounts. And one of the reasons they believe that is because they see differences, discrepancies between the Gospel narratives.
Yes. Despite the fact that Matthew and Luke are often word-for-word copies of Mark, where they diverge is quite telling. Matthew would sometimes correct details that he thought Mark got wrong, and would change some details to appeal to his audience of Jews that were in conflict with the Pharisees. Luke was writing to a Gentile audience and seemed to be concerned with making it obvious that being a Christian won't stop you from also being a good citizen of the Roman Empire. And while the Synoptic Gospels all depict Jesus as being rather human, John's Jesus can't stop talking about how he's the Son of God, even waltzing into the temple to drive out the money changers with a whip and declaring himself to be the Son of God and prophesying about his future resurrection. The Synoptics have this event happen at the end of Jesus' ministry, but John puts it at the beginning. And since the Synoptics make it fairly obvious that this is the act that got Jesus arrested, it is hard to imagine the Jewish leadership allowing such a blatant blasphemer to run free for a few more years after the event, giving him a second chance to come back and do the same thing again before arresting him. And had it actually happened twice, as is commonly asserted by the people who want the Bible to be free of error and contradiction, then you would expect at least one of the eyewitnesses that you claim are writing these books to mention both occurrences. This is no small event that can just be dismissed. This is a significant act that symbolizes the defiance of authority. In the Synoptics, it is essentially the culmination of his life's ministry. It would be a most egregious omission indeed to not mention him having done it before, especially for Mark, who was very fond of using a bracketing device for certain thematic elements. For instance, in Mark, the cursing of the fig tree actually kind of makes sense as a literary device. In Mark, Jesus goes to the fig tree, curses it for not bearing fruit out of season, then goes and cleanses the temple and comes back the next day to find the fig tree withered and dead, and then proceeds to use the event as a springboard for teaching a lesson on having faith in God. In this way, Mark is using the fig tree story as an allegory for God having abandoned the temple. Remember, Mark was written just after the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 CE, so he is using the story to explain why God would allow Romans to destroy his temple. It is no longer the season for temple worship. Jesus has overturned the temple requirements by providing a permanent sacrifice for the atonement of sins, so the temple has withered and died. Now, Matthew, when copying Mark, had a thing for cutting out material that he thought to be unnecessary to the story. He also had a thing for literalism. In the prophecy in Zechariah about the king of Zion coming on a donkey, it says, on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. The other three Gospels just have Jesus coming into town on a colt, as that covers all the bases. A colt can be both the foal of a donkey and a donkey itself, so only one animal is necessary. But Matthew decided to have Jesus ride into town on a donkey and a colt, and so cover all the potential interpretations of the prophecy. So when Matthew was copying out the fig story, he either didn't notice the literary device, or he didn't see the need to preserve it and wanted to cut out what he saw as unnecessary details. So rather than having Jesus walking back and forth to the same fig tree and the curse taking effect overnight, he had Jesus curse the fig tree, which then immediately withered. So in Mark, the fig tree thing kinda works and makes sense in the literary context. In Matthew, it looks like Jesus gets irrationally angry at the fact that a tree won't bear fruit out of season. Also, I know that in the J. Warner Wallace School of Apologetics, the idea is that different eyewitnesses telling a story differently confirm that both stories are likely true, unless there is a direct and irreconcilable contradiction. Well, here we've seen that in Mark, Jesus curses the fig tree, then cleanses the temple, then goes home, goes to sleep, comes back in the morning, and sees that the fig tree has withered. So he then gives a sermon about faith. Matthew explicitly states that the tree withered immediately. Now, if these are two eyewitness accounts that weren't written down until a few decades later, I could see how they could be based on a real story, but they can't both be an accurate depiction of the event. And since it is a well-known literary device in Mark, and Matthew copied Mark, we can actually infer that it likely wasn't a real event, and that neither Matthew nor Mark were eyewitnesses.
Times when the different Gospels will talk about the same event, but include different details or change the story.
Yes, and the problem is not that they're including different details, it's that they often include conflicting details, such as the aforementioned time span between the cursing of the fig tree and the withering of the fig tree.
the question is, do they really have differences? And if they do have differences, what does that mean for us? Can we trust the Gospels?
That depends what you mean by trust. You can trust the Gospels to be a window into the beliefs of the people that produced them. By examining Mark, you can find that it was written to a mixed audience, likely mostly made up of Greek-speaking Jews of the diaspora, given his translation of Aramaic phrases in his story, something that wouldn't have been necessary for the Aramaic-speaking Jews of Judea. He also explains Jewish customs and traditions in more detail than would be required to make it friendly to a Gentile reader as well. Matthew was writing to a Jewish audience, correcting some of the mistakes that Mark made about some of the Jewish customs, and was also more familiar with ancient Palestine, so corrected some of Mark's geographical mistakes as well. Luke was writing to a Gentile audience, and seemed to be writing to placate the Romans to a degree, emphasizing that Jesus and his followers are law-abiding citizens who keep the peace. So far, most of this is pretty much undisputed, except for the people who would deny that Mark has any errors in it, and so have to find excuses for things like why Jesus would go from Tyre through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee. If you look at a map, that route makes zero sense. So apologists have to come up with reasons why Jesus would have gone so far out of his way to Sidon on his way to the Sea of Galilee, and explain why it doesn't mention anything that he did while in Sidon, but still felt the need to mention that he went there. But the Gospel of John is a bit more contentious. John is where most of the anti-Semiticism can be found in the Bible, but despite this, some will argue that it was directed at an audience of Jews. Now, maybe it was, and it was meant to emphasize the importance of the ordinary Jews' conflict with the Jewish religious leaders of the time, but it could also be directed at a Christian audience, as John includes many explanations that appear to be post hoc responses to early criticisms of Christianity, not to mention the fact that it makes certain facts that may have been disputed in the early church rather explicit. Was Jesus the adopted Son of God, or was he literally a deity that came down to earth? John makes it quite clear that Jesus is divine. But if Jesus is literally a god, then why would he ever show signs of weakness, like being tempted in the desert? Well, John skips that story. Can't have a weak Jesus that could do something as pitiful as being tempted by Satan offering him stuff, right? Also quite telling is that in the synoptics, Jesus is quite unwilling to perform miracles as a proof of who he is. He explicitly states that no sign will be given to this generation. But then when we read through John, there is no mention of miracles, instead referring to them all as signs, often for the direct purpose of Jesus demonstrating his divinity. So yeah, all this to say that yes, we can trust the Gospels, as being a way of figuring out what some of the various beliefs of the early church were, but definitely not as historical narratives.
One of these examples that I'll see thrown out there is the story of the discovery of Jesus' empty tomb. The big question is, who discovered Jesus' empty tomb after his crucifixion?
This one is an apologist's favorite. I suspect that's because it can definitely seem contradictory at first blush, but it's easy enough to harmonize with an appeal to the fact that none of the Gospels specifically exclude any of the people mentioned in the other stories from being present but not named in theirs. So it is a contradiction that appears to be glaring, but it has a simple potential solution that anyone can understand. After all, not mentioning people that were there at the time is something that we all do all the time. Just today being when I'm writing my script, I posted a story about how my kid twisted his ankle, and while myself and Mrs. Rhino were figuring out whether his injuries warranted taking him in for an x-ray, my Google Home speaker piped up with the helpful suggestion of, "Turn on the poison gas." If Mrs. Rhino tells her side of the story, she might decide to include a detail about how my other son was there too. And that is true, he was there, and that does not contradict my story, which left him out. So, see? Each gospel author recorded a different collection of people at the tomb, but that doesn't mean that the others were wrong. It's just a big old party at the tomb that morning, I guess. So, yes, this one looks bad, but it's fairly easy to reconcile. But there are contradictions that are easier to miss that don't have such a straightforward reconciliation that you won't find apologists addressing very often, such as the fact that the events of Jesus' crucifixion in John could not have taken place in the same year as the crucifixion in the Synoptics. In the Synoptics, the Last Supper is the Passover meal and took place on Thursday, with Jesus being crucified on Friday, with the appeal to Pilate for his body to be brought down early being granted because the Sabbath was the next day, the Sabbath being Saturday. All four Gospels agree that his body was taken off the cross the day before the Sabbath, but in John, it specifically mentions that Jesus is being crucified before the Passover. meaning that the Passover meal was on a different day of the week than it was in the Synoptic Gospels. Think about it like this. If I told you that I went out for dinner the day after Christmas, which was on a weekend, and then someone else told you that they went out for dinner with me the same day, on the weekend, but it was the day before Christmas, then we can't both be talking about Christmas in the same year. Christmas can't be on a Friday and a Saturday in the same year, because that's not how dates work. And while the contradiction itself is rather small and easy to miss, its implications are pretty disastrous for the claim of biblical inerrancy. How can you call a book inerrant if it can't even agree with itself about what year the most important event in the book took place?
It's actually very common for me to see differences between eyewitnesses. If two witnesses see the same thing, if I talk to them, I'll typically get differences in their stories.
Yes, but let's circle back around to the fact that three of the stories are, for the most part, identical, word for word. But then they diverge in spots where it suits the motivations of the author, keeping their target audience in mind.
In fact, it's so extremely common to see differences that when I don't see a difference, that's cause for me to be suspicious.
So, for instance, if one person made a statement, and then when you move on to the next person, their statement includes a 90% verbatim copy of the first statement, but then goes on to embellish certain details, you would be suspicious of that, right? Because that's the relationship between Matthew and Mark. Now, just for clarity, because this is a point that had me confused in the past, when we say that Matthew copied 90% of Mark, it's not that both books are 90% identical. It's that 90% of Mark is contained verbatim within Matthew. Matthew added on a lot of extra material. The five discourses of Matthew all have shorter parallels in Luke and Mark, but none are quite as lengthy as Matthew's, which is why they are the five discourses of Matthew rather than the five discourses of the Synoptics.
For example, I might talk to a victim who says, a guy ran up and grabbed my purse off my shoulder and stole it and ran off. And then I might talk to the witness across the street who would tell me something like, yeah, I saw it. I saw everything. Three guys ran up to that woman, stole the purse off her shoulder and ran off. And so as the investigator, I'm stuck with two differing witness statements, and I've got to decide what am I going to do with it. When I have something along those lines, there's a couple things for me to keep in mind. One is that there's actually a lot of things that those two witnesses agreed on. They both agreed that a robbery had happened. They both agreed on who the victim of the robbery was. They both agreed on the property that was taken. They even both agreed that at least one male suspect is involved. They just disagree about whether there's additional. They definitely agree on more than they disagree about.
Yes, but what would you think if they worded it exactly the same way, but then it turned out that the two additional suspects identified by the person who saw it from across the street were people that that person has a grudge against? At that point, the second person's story becomes quite suspicious, does it not? So when Matthew is identical, but has clear motivations for the parts that are not identical, how is that any different?
And we want to ask a question that in the area that they disagree, is there a reasonable explanation for why they would both, how could they possibly both be telling the truth being their true recollection of the events? Could they both be truly telling their memory as it really was, but ending up with different accounts of how many suspects there were?
Yes, that's possible, but in a lot of the differences in the empty tomb story, that seems unlikely. The presence of a Roman guard seems rather noteworthy, and yet only one gospel mentions it. An earthquake and the accompanying zombie invasion of Jerusalem seems pretty darn noteworthy, and only one gospel mentions it. And yes, I am aware that Matthew's zombie invasion is actually what happens when Jesus dies, not at the empty tomb, but it's too interesting to not bring up here, which kind of helps my point that it is far too interesting for no other historical book inside or outside the Bible to have ever brought it up. And while it is an apparently minor detail, we also see that in Matthew the women witness the angel rolling the stone away from the tomb, while the other Gospels all make it clear that the stone was already rolled away before they got there. In John, Jesus actually shows up at the empty tomb. That is quite the detail to omit from the story if this is just a case of different perspectives of the same story. Hey, you know that guy whose dead body is supposed to be in there? Yeah, he was standing right behind Mary the whole time, but nah, I'll leave that bit out. It's not important to the story.
So in that case, we'd actually say that those are consistent statements, even though they're different. there's not really a good reason to believe that no robbery occurred. There's good reason to think something bad happened and that these two people really were there, in fact.
Right, but to make this analogy actually approximate the situation with the Bible, it would be more like someone was robbed, then one person who doesn't even claim to have been present for the robbery writes down an account from an anonymous perspective about what exactly happened, but did so 30 years after the fact. Then, 15 years after this first account was written and widely distributed, someone writes down another account, again from an anonymous perspective and not even claiming to have been present themselves, and this second account plagiarizes 90% of the content of the first account, but added on a bunch of expanded details while slightly altering the contents of the plagiarized text to make it seem more plausible. Seems like less of a sure thing to me.
What would be inconsistent or a problem would be if we had a victim tell us, oh, yeah, at this date and time, I was walking down the street and I got robbed. And then we talked to a witness who said, yeah, I've been here the whole time. I watched her walk down the street and I know nothing happened. Now, that would be an issue. That would be truly conflicting statements.
So, for instance, when the Synoptic Gospels say that Simon of Cyrene was compelled to carry Jesus' cross, but John says that he carried his own cross? That's one of those places where it appears as though John was writing with the specific intent of contradicting the other accounts, because John's Jesus is fully God. None of that adoptionist bullshit being pushed by the other gospels in circulation. Jesus didn't need any help. Why would he? He carried his own cross.
Because it's not possible for them to both be true. There's no reasonable explanation. So we'd really start to question in that case, well, did a robbery even occur? And if it did, who's telling the truth here? Were both these people actually even there?
Good question. The Gospels all record details of conversations that, had they actually been written by the people whose names are on them, would have been impossible for them to have overheard. Jesus had a private conversation with Pilate, just Jesus and Pilate. So if the Gospel authors were eyewitnesses, how did they record these details? And we're talking in this video specifically about the empty tomb. It was the women going to the tomb, no men. The only one that could plausibly have had the tomb story written by someone who was there is John, because Mary went to the tomb, apparently alone, but before anything can actually happen, she runs back and grabs two of the disciples. And then it is these two disciples who see all the stuff happen at the tomb, except for when Jesus himself shows up. That is after Mary is left crying by herself there. So that actually kind of directly contradicts the other accounts as well. They are all rather specific about the empty tomb being found and looked into by the women, who then go and tell the men, rather than the women finding the stone rolled away and then going to get the men to investigate. So the Gospels are full of conversations and events that the authors would not have been present for, even if they were written by the people whose names are on them.
That's something that would cause me some serious concern, but the statements of the Gospels are more like the first statements where we could reasonably understand why somebody would include or choose to exclude information.
No. Harmonizing the empty tomb stories requires quite a bit of stretching and twisting. And then once you're done all of that, you're still left with the direct contradictions, like the fact that they can't all have taken place in the same year.
When one gospel says that Mary Magdalene discovers an empty tomb but doesn't mention anyone else being with her, that's not actually inconsistent with the next gospel author who says she's there with the other Mary.
Maybe not, but the one that mentions Mary Magdalene also explicitly has her running back and grabbing the men to go look into the tomb before she looks in herself, which is a direct contradiction with the other three accounts, regardless of how many other women may or may not have been present.
Or whatever the case may be. You know, as an investigator, in the end, I'm going to take the statements of everybody, the victim, the witness, and I'm going to write them down as they were given to me. I'm not going to combine the two into one story about what I think happened. Instead, I'm going to document the victim's statement and then the witness's statement so that we can really see where the evidence is going to lead us.
And the statements that make up the Gospels lead us to the conclusion that they were not actually written by eyewitnesses and often borrowed quite heavily from each other.
The Bible actually is consistent with that type of philosophy. The Bible includes all four of these witness statements, all four Gospels. So we, instead of rather than having some compiler put them all together or throw three out so that there's just one gospel left.
Oh, you mean like what was done with the Pentateuch? Or with the ending of Mark? and actually the whole field of study that specializes in recreating what the Bible originally said, revolves entirely around harmonizing conflicting manuscripts. Because remember, we don't actually have any of the originals to know what they would have said. We have a collection of thousands of manuscripts with no two being entirely identical. And contrary to what Frank Turek will tell you...
So by not preserving the original, you actually are able to preserve the original better.
The more conflicting manuscripts we have, the harder a time we have figuring out exactly what the original text would have said. So scholars spend their days comparing conflicting manuscript traditions in order to figure out what they think the original text most likely said, with no way of actually verifying it. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Dolores Lehman, who says, "How did you get the idea that Jesus introduced the idea of hell? That's weird." Well, I got that idea from the fact that hell is never described or mentioned in the Old Testament at all. The only references to an afterlife are that of Sheol, which is roughly the equivalent to the Greek concept of Hades. It's not particularly good, it's not particularly bad, it just is. Kind of an eternal meh. Heaven isn't a place for most people. That's where God lives with his angels and a couple of hand-picked prophets. Everyone else goes to Sheol. It isn't until Jesus comes along in the New Testament that any description of hell is ever given. You don't find references to the lake of fire in the Old Testament. No places of weeping and gnashing of teeth. Nothing like that. There are sects of Judaism still around today that don't believe in the concept of hell, because they have no reason to, as it wasn't introduced until the Christian writings showed up. And actually, the various Jewish beliefs regarding the afterlife seem way better than the Christian ones. The worst I've seen is that there is a kind of hell, but it's a place where sin is cleansed from your soul so that you can enter heaven once it's done. So no infinite punishment for finite crimes. Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, Lynn Dobbs, Mark McManus, What Jesus, and all the rest, who are the thieves who stole the purse that is my channel. If you'd like to rob poor little old ladies, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, which are linked in the description. If you'd like to listen to my videos in podcast form, the link for that is also in the description, as well as links to my social media accounts and my P.O. Box address. See you next time!